Hello and welcome to the agency. This is Eugene Napick in Toronto.
Hi. This is Candy Minx for the agency in Albuquerque, New Mexico. How are you doing, Eugene?
I'm doing good, Candy. Great. Are you doing?
Really good. I'm pretty excited because I think our listeners are really going to enjoy something different. We were lucky enough to interview George Sieg from the conference I've attended in New Mexico. He is a panel leader and he curates a whole session. He's been doing it for 2 years on esoterica, magic, and occultism. And he's got a lot of insight, a lot of experience. He's very knowledgeable, and he's very articulate. And I think we had a lot of fun talking with him last night, didn't we?
Oh, I had a really good time talking to him. He's just so well-spoken on his topics, very well-researched. He knows his stuff, handled our questions beautifully. It was a real pleasure to interview him. I think our audience is going to really enjoy this.
I do too. Now I'm just going to qualify that I'm still sitting in the library at the Hotel Andalus. We've recorded here now. This will be our fourth time recording in this room. We've got some loud music playing. But last night we sat and we recorded the episode and then George joined us for dinner. So that was a lot of fun too. We actually got to know him a little bit better. And he suggested I sign up for a panel meeting next year. In his category, in his sessions, he teaches at an Aboriginal based university, a trade college here in New Mexico. And, I'll put some more details about that later. I don't know if I did bring his session. I didn't bring his session information with me. That's just so typical. So I'm sorry, I can't say what school he taught at.
It's pretty fantastic that he's invited you to be a panelist for next year. Congratulations.
I know, I'm really excited. I can't believe it. And he had so much encouragement when I told him about some of the things in my paper and what I'm finding in McCarthy. He was a very avid supporter of that. When I read out some of the numbers to him, he started smiling. So that was pretty exciting. My paper did go over pretty well. I had a lot of encouragement from the other people at the conference. So that felt good. And I think we're going to play. We recorded last night with George. And I think we're going to just play that because there's a lot for our listeners to take in.
Yeah. So this whole episode is going to be the George Sieg episode. So without further ado, here is our interview with George. Hello and welcome to the agency. This is Eugene Napick here in Toronto.
And this is Candy Minx here in Albuquerque. And we're pretty excited to have a guest here, George
Sieg.
Thank you.
Hello.
And George is
Hi, George. From...
Hello, Eugene. It's good to be here.
I'm so excited to get going. I'd like to say that we're here at the Pop Culture Convention in Albuquerque. And it's the 41st year of the Pop Culture Convention. And George, I noticed him right away because he seemed to have a lot of people around him. And he had so many panels going on. I was very curious how he was able to get so many people interested, and that it seemed to indicate to me that people were interested in his topic, which in general would be the esotericism and occultism area.
And magic.
And magic. Thank you.
Next year, the area will have an expanded name, esotericism, occultism, and magic, in order to better include the full range of worldviews described by these concepts and their appearance in popular culture.
Fantastic. And I would describe George as a time traveler because I see him standing on one end in the ancient world and then in the other having a very mobile sense of pop culture. So to me, that is super interesting.
George, are you a practitioner as well? Do you practice some form of magic?
No.
How did you get interested in this set of topics?
I was interested in mythology from a very young age. And of course, had the appreciation of fantasy genres and science fiction, and a fairly early enthusiasm for role-playing games. I encountered Dungeons and Dragons around the same time as being introduced to The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings as a elementary school child. And by the time I was in high school, I had encountered comparative religions literature. I studied at a very liberal Catholic high school, and as a freshman was, as were all the freshmen at that high school, introduced to really the concepts of Western magic in a special unit that was actually taught every year as part of Western civilization that focused on magic, alchemy, and the occult sciences as like the three pillars of the occult worldview in the Middle Ages. Oh, also including astrology. And so I was quite amazed as I began researching this to discover that there were still traditions surviving into the contemporary world where people explored and even practiced engaging with things like the Hermetic worldview. And, you know, after going through studies of mysticism and Eastern philosophy and ancient mystery cults through my undergraduate years and doing graduate work in Zoroastrian religion, as well as mysticism, I encountered the academic study of Western esotericism as a developing field, and had the privilege of studying with Professor Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who was already well known as the world expert on the reception of the occult in National Socialist Germany, as well as the survival of various Aryan-centered traditions and neo-Nazi occultism into the contemporary period. So when I met him at a Theosophy conference and learned that he was establishing a research center at the University of Exeter to study all forms of esotericism and occultism, I had the honor of becoming one of his first doctoral students. And so unfortunately, the research center no longer exists because he passed away unexpectedly. But a number of us did. Thank you. Yeah, it was quite a blow to the whole field, really. But there were, you know, a bit over 10, I think, scholars who did end up receiving a doctorate in esotericism, which is very unusual. It's a highly interdisciplinary field.
Okay, at this point, George, I think we need to help our listeners understand. Could you tell us in a way that we might understand what magic is to you or in the contemporary world and what esotericism is? I feel like some of our listeners won't know.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, I'm glad you asked first what magic is. There's a lot of ways of approaching esotericism, but I think approaching it through magical worldviews really makes the most sense, both academically and popularly.
Okay.
So I would describe a magical worldview as any worldview in which causality is understood as influenced by subjective perceptions.
Okay.
You might consider it antithetical to religious worldviews in which truth is understood primarily as validated by some kind of power structure or agreed upon authority, and perhaps at somewhat of an angle to a scientific worldview in which individual perceptions are used to validate claims about objective reality through perhaps measurement or empirical experiment, whereas magical worldviews tend to consider subjective experience to be the final authority. Esotericism would be highly systematic expressions of these worldviews that include things like symbolic languages, particular categories or mythological structures of spiritual beings, and perhaps also that embrace mystical ideas of self-transmutation. So I've already mentioned examples like alchemy, mm-hmm. like astrology. Mm-hmm. These would be examples of the kinds of systems that go together to make esoteric worldview.
Okay, I've already got two more questions all of a sudden from what you said, but one would be, can you give us examples of magic in pop culture, and that it's, you know, obviously it means a lot to people. I know Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Is there something more contemporary that we would understand what you're talking about? And two, let me think about two for a second there.
So, in the world of film and television, mm-hmm. Yes. For example, I understand there's a program called The Magicians. In fact, I haven't actually watched this one.
I haven't either.
But it's often treated as an iconic example, particularly of a magical worldview in a contemporary setting.
Okay.
Of course, I think mostly people now are familiar with the urban fantasy tropes where magic occurs in a setting where fantastic elements have intruded into the contemporary. Certainly you saw this in things like True Blood. But maybe a very excellent example of magic being represented in an occult worldview, more or less akin to how it was presented at the time, would be Strange Angel, which describes the magical endeavors of the rocket scientist Jack Parsons, who's a significant historical figure in the development of solid rocket fuel. And ultimately the space program. So you can find references to magic in popular culture, basically ranging from witchcraft style mm-hmm. depictions, like in Sabrina, mm-hmm. to more fantastic depictions, but also to depictions of historical esotericism. There was a fairly excellent program called Da Vinci's Demons, mm-hmm. which went through a few seasons. It's maybe a bit dated now, but really was a wonderful representation of the way the Western esoteric tradition already mythologized itself in the Renaissance.
Okay, why do you think this is important in contemporary culture? Right away, off the top of my head, what I heard was that if through religion or government, it's an outside force telling us how to decide what life is about, whereas magic is us having our own.
I didn't necessarily mean to say that religion was an outside force,
okay. All right.
Just that religious worldviews tend to identify and validate truth based on some kind of structure of authority, not necessarily externalized authorities. This could very well be an internalized authority.
Okay.
But personal experience is less likely to be used to validate truth than the application of concepts suggesting that there's some kind of objective structure that needs to be in accord with. Whereas magical worldviews, whether or not they're individualist, will still use personal experience as a deciding feature, mainly because if someone believes that they've either caused something to happen by magic mm-hmm. or experienced something mm-hmm. that happened by magic, the only way they could draw that conclusion is through something experiential. Whereas someone could apply a religious worldview in a purely intellectual way.
Okay. Why do you think, now listen, out of our panels at the conference, I'm going to change gears here, the Cormac McCarthy sessions, which I was part of, I think we had half a dozen. Yet George, if I don't know if you saw his layout, they've got 15 panels here this year alone. And they're usually pretty busy and popular. What do you think that is?
So I think this also ties to the first part of your previous question about why this is important.
Yes.
Magical worldviews are being increasingly well and thoroughly represented in popular media.
Yes.
It's not just fiction, because only in the last 2 years it was widely publicized that various witch covens claimed to be engaged in magic for political purposes against the American president, for example.
Okay.
That whether or not one takes such endeavors seriously,
yes.
It would have been inconceivable even a decade ago for something like that to receive the level of media attention which it did. So not only are we seeing fictional representations of magical worldviews, it's become much more acceptable to claim a magical worldview and claim to be enacting it regularly. As to why this is happening, that may be a different question, but I think the easiest way to establish this is to actually look at fiction reboots and the way they handle magical content.
Okay, great.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch used magic almost in a symbolic fashion. It was simply a trope. It was a part of the story which was necessary to the genre. If you look at something like The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, there's a fairly detailed representation of a magical worldview, not necessarily a realistic one, but quite detailed. Similarly, in Strange Angel, even though quite a lot of Jack Parsons' experiences and magical interests and workings are omitted, both for dramatic purposes and maybe also you know, the necessity to avoid representations that involve complicated intellectual property issues. It is based on a biography, a very good one. And what they do represent in the show, even if it's not exactly accurate to the particular rituals he was engaged with, the way magic is presented seems in accord with the way, as a practitioner, he and those around him would have understood it at the time, and the traditions that they're showing still understand it in that way.
Okay.
That's quite a dramatic difference from when the relevance of magic to historical events was only hinted at in media or fiction, as if it was of less importance, perhaps, than something religious or scientific in character.
Do you see any crossover with traditional religion and magic? I'm thinking, for instance, people who say that they've made a deal with the devil.
I would actually venture that even though I think it's actually fairly easy to define the primary features of a worldview and distinguish fairly clearly from those that are primarily religious or primarily magical, there are many, many worldviews that partake of both enough that we could use terms like an esoteric religion, an occult religion, perhaps even a magical religion. And because of that, probably most religions retain some beliefs that would fit a magical worldview. But there will be a few outlying exceptions, particularly theories of political religion. I mean, earlier, Candy mentioned religion and politics being used as an authority. If you apply models of the study of religion in identifying political ideologies that become that sort of transcend the role of what we might think of in America as civic religion. Things like pledging the flag or showing a certain degree of generic respect for monotheistic morality.
Okay.
If one goes beyond that to examine authoritarian governments that rely on ideology, or even more extremely totalitarian ideologies. It's well established that a lot of these exhibit features similar to all-encompassing religious ideologies. So if we were to identify them as something like a political religion, and this concept was, just to give you an academic example, really explored by Robert Lifton in his work on what has been colloquially called brainwashing, and probably more accurately described as thought reform. Okay. It seems fairly clear, for example, that various forms of totalitarian communism, particularly Maoism, behave as though they were ideologically totalizing religious worldviews, even if the content that Western people, for example, would expect to be in a religion isn't there. So, of course, there's no belief in God, spirits, miracles, nothing like that. It's materialistic, but the structure seems to match the structure of authoritarian religious beliefs. So for this reason, one might be able to say that even though it's rare to find a religious worldview that has no magical beliefs at all, I think Maoism or comparable materialist totalitarian ideologies would qualify.
Okay, so then Eugene was thinking about, is there any, I'm going to take this a little further than idea of a deal with the devil. Is there such a thing, do you ever see a negative side of this? Because I think mostly there's a very positive sense for me, thinking about the popularity of magic and pop culture, is that people are being more diverse. We're allowing more different ideas to exist and they're becoming stronger. We're not just looking at 10 world religions. There's thousands, as you say, maybe more. Is there a negative side to this in your idea? Is there something
a negative
like,
side to what?
To something like someone who might say, well, you know, you mentioned neo-Nazism earlier, or deals with the devil. Is there something like that that would also be rising, or would that be a separate category? I don't know if I'm asking a very good question.
Are you thinking, Candy, of for instance, using magic to cast nasty spells upon people?
Okay.
So now there's four questions, okay, but I think I can remember that. Going back to referencing concepts of diabolical pacts.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether the original context sounded like it had something to do with religion. Okay. I'll answer that is simply to add a category.
Okay.
Which has come to be of increasing usefulness, I think, in the academic study of Satanism and related worldviews.
Okay.
And that category would be an anti-religion, which tends to develop when a worldview is using the aesthetics and the imagery of religion, maybe a particular religion that it is counter to, with the function of contradicting either features of that religion or religious worldviews in general. And such an anti-religion may well, but would not always, but I think quite often, might include elements of a magical worldview. So I think a diabolical pact would be a great example of a magical anti-religious operation. As to I'm trying to remember what your second part of your question was, negative aspects of belief in an engagement with magical. Oh, I remember you, neo-Nazis.
Yes, yes,
for example.
Yes.
And whether that's a separate issue.
Yes.
I think neo-Nazism is a very particular worldview with very particular causes and conditions surrounding it. And so I don't think there's any reason to directly associate neo-Nazism with the popularity of magical worldviews, but it may be that the same cultural conditions that promote interest in and development of esoteric worldviews might also promote the development and flourishing of a wider range of available worldviews, including some that are quite subversive to prevailing social norms.
There you go. That's what I was.
Professor Goodwin
reaching
Clark,
for. You're better at saying it than I am.
Professor Goodrich Clark's model for historical periods in which interest in esotericism develops, which is something he worked into his survey of the Western esoteric tradition, which kind of summarized all his research on those worldviews in general, rather than just National Socialist ones. His idea, and this is something that other scholars have supported and that I find quite convincing, is that when the prevailing narrative of a society, be it local culture or a wider-ranging civilization, comes to be destabilized by sufficient interaction with other worldviews. So we can particularly think of cities at the hubs of trade networks, at different times in the ancient world, or we could consider colonial periods where many different cultures are being encountered by the colonial powers, and then their material is brought back to the seats of the colonial power, or perhaps a current period where globalization has begun to make a huge variety of worldviews available to many more people due to the ease at which information is transmitted. Mm-hmm. It seems to be periods like this where stable cultural narratives are either challenged or destabilized by the wider availability of information. Esoteric worldviews seem to become more appealing in these times because they're using subjective personal experience as a standard, but because they're systematic rather than simply a purely a magical worldview, which one could just as easily develop in isolation, because esoteric worldviews are highly systematic and tend to really embrace correspondence systems and symbols and communication and also focus on self-transformation, they become immensely attractive to people who are perhaps lacking some kind of source of cultural authority to give them a narrative of truth.
Well, you said very deeply what I intuitively was wondering about your panels and their popularity and the rise of magic and esotericism in pop culture. You pretty much answered my question right there, which also suggested something else to me. In those times of upheaval, sometimes we will see I don't want to say trance or liminality or Eugene, between the phase, let's say Joseph Campbell and our listeners, there might be a time when you're initiated in something and you're in a confused state or a hypnotic state. Would you say that might be it? And it's often in a time of upheaval would be a good metaphor for when you're not, you're confused.
Would that be close the concept to, of liminality or even just generally confusion that you're
struggling with
applying to an individual I think does apply on a broader scale. So individuals are experiencing this, and also the cultural zeitgeist itself can seemingly represent this by maybe lacking a coherent narrative, or instead of simply one, two, or a few in conflict, there will be just a plurality to choose from.
Right.
So pluralistic societies are more likely to feature the availability of esoteric worldviews in general.
Okay, very well said. What about music? Do you have any music that you would say represents more magic? I mean, I think music is very magic-based anyway. We just love it. It goes beyond us. But is there any trend in music right now you're seeing?
I don't think I'm enough of a music scholar to answer, but I can tell you one thing that I do know, because a roundtable in my conference area in the previous year focused on it, and I'm in the process of editing an anthology of research about esotericism and occultism in contemporary popular culture, and so some research by the chair of music in our association, Cody Smith, was of great interest because he had written an article about the immense popularity of the band Ghost, which seems to have brought, seems to have gone well beyond the musical parameters or constraints of the metal genre into mainstream popularity. And Ghost, through its aesthetics and its lyrical content, advances Luciferian and satanic ideas and sort of aesthetics so directly that it goes beyond, in any sense, being anti-Christian. In fact, their content doesn't really suggest much of the anti-part of an anti-religion. One of their best-known songs would be He Is, which is in the style of Christian devotional music, but is dedicated to Lucifer as a knowledge bringer.
All right.
And there's nothing particularly adversarial about any of it. Uh-huh. It's simply using these figures in a very enthusiastic way. That might be an example of a magical worldview, or at least the aesthetics of a magical worldview, so intense that it goes past the oppositional or countercultural or adversarial elements you'd normally associate it with it. And I think that goes back to your original immediate question, the first example, I think, even that you generated in the question was Diabolical Pacts, followed by Cursing People.
Right.
So,
I guess that's the paranoid reaction to magic.
Well, and that it seems fairly standard that magical worldviews inevitably involve the possibility of use of whatever magical techniques and practices are included in the worldview for malign intentions. And given the likelihood that magical worldviews will come into conflict, for example, with religious worldviews, not only are those features very likely to be seen as prominent, the way they're then represented by a religious worldview will be even more prominent. So by the early modern period, for example, both Catholics and Protestants were presenting not only witchcraft, but magic in general as being fueled by the devil. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, fueled witch crazes, which fueled quite a lot of fires.
Yes.
And that association remained very intense in Western civilization, really up to the present, such that diabolical satanic witches are such an accessible trope that even the Sabrina reboot, which is fairly nuanced in the details of the characterization and the way magic is represented, is still using that as a default paradigm. So I think your questions, in a way, include part of their answer in themselves.
Yeah, okay.
That the way magic is represented by less magical worldviews will, if they are culturally influential, it will have a huge effect on the way magic is perceived in that culture.
Well, let me put it this way. For me, where I sit, one of my idols is William Burroughs, and he used magic as a creative force as well. Do you have any input on that or observation on that?
My observation would be that it's much easier to popularly identify William Burroughs as a sorcerer now and have that remain uncontroversial and easily well supported, whereas in previous decades of research, even though if someone dug into the material, it wouldn't be difficult to establish that Burroughs regarded himself as a sorcerer and was engaged in the esoteric and occult practices, it might not have been quite as easy to comfortably say that as an academic researcher in a one-line statement. As it is now.
Right, which brings us full circle that you have a very stimulating career in academia regarding these topics that I think many of us don't realize how seriously you could approach them and how passionately you could approach them.
Well, I think that may be changing, considering that, the history, it's interesting transatlantically that in North America, it seems that the history of magic is very well accepted as an academic field. It's very successful in medieval studies and Renaissance studies, but it's that history part. It doesn't necessarily leap across into contemporary history of magic. More likely, interest in alternative religions in the New Age, in even in perhaps in anti-religions, certainly interest in Gnosticism flourishes. Mm-hmm. The study of esotericism as an interdisciplinary field and as a worldview is much more well established, if not pervasive, in European academia. My interest is in really being an American scholar, but who has studied in European institutions. I'm very interested in tying those things together, because as I thought your question implied and was so well founded, one can see a historical development of magical worldviews being standard and maybe inherent to indigenous human societies.
Right.
Esotericism flourishing as systematic worldviews and conversionist religions spread across mm-hmm. the planet, and what we know as occultism being a kind of scientific development from esotericism, wherein scientific or purportedly scientific ideas are used to try to explain magic and esoteric worldviews, update them to whatever is contemporary, and add to them an idea of progress over time. Of course, much of contemporary esotericism is still purely esoteric or magical worldviews, but the development of occultism definitely helped bring the esoteric and the occult very much into popular consciousness around the turn of the previous century,
right,
with what we call the modern occult revival, things like theosophy. In many ways, those worldviews became mainstream. That, of course, led to interest in things like psychical research, mm-hmm. Leading to interest in paranormal and psychic phenomena. Mm-hmm. So it seems that every era has a mainstream expression of these ideas, but that only this current global information society really allows all these worldviews to be easily available and then easily compared with each other. That's also confusing, though. And so,
yes. Well, I feel confused. I mean, yeah. I do feel confused, because I'm like, I want to get my hand on what does esotericism mean. And it may be a mystery that I can't put into one soundbite for our listeners. You know, I'm cycling around that.
It might be, but I could try.
All right, you could try.
I would describe esotericism as systematic magical worldviews that can be used for self-transformation.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
Well, thank you. I hope academic colleagues also find it beautiful. But at least it was in one line.
Yes. Eugene, do you have questions?
I have. Well, something just came to mind when you talked, George, about the importance of personal or subjective experience in terms of having alternative worldviews or magical worldviews. I couldn't help but think of an article I read in my local paper this morning about the fellow Mike Hughes, who launched himself with a steam-powered rocket yesterday to his death in order to try to prove by seeing that in fact the earth was flat. Is that kind of anti-science?
No, that's bad science. And in this instance, fatally bad science.
Yeah, very fatally. It was maybe he's a candidate for the Darwin Award on that count.
Story though, because I hate to see someone so involved in that but the
example does remind me actually to refer to one of the major sources for the sort of basic contrast I was making between yes. worldviews, because the source also then examines instances where the methodology of one worldview is sort of conflated with the practice of another that leads to, well, things like what you just described, sadly enough. The reference has written as an academic under his, as far as I know, his legal name, Lionel Snell, who wrote a significant and interesting essay for the short-lived influential journal for the academic study of magic, in which he addressed diverse worldviews which he also explored in practice in a number of his books written under the pseudonym Ramsey Dukes, one of the sort of grandfathers or maybe great uncles of the chaos magic movement. And so he was quite interested in how confusion of method of worldview leads to everything from rather superstitious exercises and trying to use magical worldviews to acquire objective truth to perhaps pseudoscience in which subjective methods are used to produce, to try to get like scientific truth, or perhaps various examples of, I think his example of bad religion might be claiming that miracles prove that your religion is true, when in fact they may simply prove that someone somewhere involved had a magical experience.
Right. Right. That is a good one. That's a good way to put it. Would you have any advice on maybe an intro book that someone's maybe not quite as experienced as you could have? Do you have any recommendations for books for people who might be listening that they kind of want to read something? Have you got a book out yet?
Well, Nicholas Goodrich Clark's The Western Esoteric Traditions is written really at an intro level. I would say that, especially given the availability of all but the most, I would say in the colloquial sense, the most esoteric academic information now, anyone with a passing interest in the history, in global history or history of Western civilization, would be able to read that book and appreciate its arguments. But it does tend to approach esotericism through Western history, and you know, the title says it, this is rather Western. If you were interested in a more global approach, which is taken really by the major scholars in the American side of the study of esotericism, who also have collaborated to form an association for the study of esotericism, ASE, which I'm also part of, its founder, Arthur Burse Lewis, has written many books, a lot of which address issues of totalitarian worldviews, religious conversion, gurus, a lot of other related things. But he also has like a key sort of and a very brief work on magic and mysticism in Western esotericism, and that sort of ties this to examples that may be more familiar from Gnosticism, examples that may be more familiar from, you know, global studies of mystical ideas. So that may appeal to readers who also have an interest in mysticism or even New Age thought.
All right. Well, thank you. I found this very fascinating, completely over my head. What do you have to say there, Eugene?
You must have some really, really spicy panels, because there's such a broad range of ideas that fit into your set of topics. Do you ever have anything go wrong in the panels, like some really bad arguments?
Well, do you guys get some intense arguments or anything?
I've actually not yet seen any kind of argument in any of the panels or roundtables. Perhaps because any of the debates within these fields tend to be very sort of meta-theoretical debates about how one category should be presented rather than another, perhaps to better understand their global development. But sort of the basic role of these worldviews, particularly in popular culture, is actually so recognizable and accessible that there isn't really significant debate about that. Instead, I would say they're very interesting and lively discussions, because there's such a diversity of these worldviews, and they appear across really all media, so, you know, film, television, literature, gaming. You won't find media where they don't appear, but that's only the media side, right? So if there's an interest in history and culture, they're going to appear there. And there's usually going to be some tie-in to significant figures or influences from other academic disciplines. So these roundtables and panels are so exciting and interesting and engaging, not because you know, the chairs in the hotel would have been needed to be bolted to the floor to avoid chairs, which is a joke I've actually heard Marvin Meyer say at a major Gnosticism conference back when the Gospel of Judas was discovered in like 2009. There were plenty of chair throwing jokes at the conference because there were some pretty intense arguments about how to interpret, you know, this particular Gnostic text. But in terms of contemporary esotericism studies, what people really want to do in these panels and roundtables is share the details that they've been able to find in one piece of media, in one area of culture, and compare that to the wealth of other knowledge available from other perspectives. And, you know, much like esoteric worldviews often combining very well to produce new systems of thought, the research on them seems to work the same way. So I don't think we'll be needing to bolt the chairs in the hotel in Albuquerque to the floor anytime soon during the roundtable.
I have another thing that I noticed in your session list that caught my eye and got me very excited. Can you tell me a little bit about the meta consciousness of Joker or Deadpool? I really wish I could have been at that session. I saw something about that. What does that mean? And I'm a big fan of the Joker.
I can credit a scholar named David Pearsall for, in the course of the roundtable discussion, identifying what he believed was the earliest use of what we've termed metaconsciousness of the Joker, which was Grant Morrison's recension of the Joker. Mm-hmm. In, I believe, an Arkham Asylum story. This simply refers to in-universe came to be referred to as the Joker's super sanity. The claim that the Joker only appeared insane, in fact, he was super or hyper sane, because the Joker evidences awareness in the text of the comic book that he's a comic book character.
Right.
And this was then elaborated to suggest that all the different versions of the Joker were a consequence of the Joker developing the super sanity and perhaps in some Gnostic way attempting to break the constraints of his existence as a comic book character. This, of course, is then echoed later by Marvel's Deadpool, evincing this, what we're calling metaconsciousness, which is awareness of being a comic book character. Of course, Deadpool extends that to being aware in a film that he's a film character.
Yes.
And eventually produces what might be one of the most dramatic examples of anti-cosmic Gnosticism in fiction, in which Deadpool kills the Marvel Universe. Successfully overcomes, in perhaps a somewhat self-undermining way, his existence as a comic book character. So this concept of metaconsciousness then can be applied really across fiction in different fourth wall breaking situations. Frank Underwood apparently breaks the fourth wall pretty frequently.
I think so.
This seems to often be associated with characters who are either villainous protagonists, villains, Iago, all the way back to Shakespeare, maybe anti-heroes, and I'm not sure, I think Deadpool's gone beyond category by now.
Yeah, I guess too, for me, how I take it is that, you know, there's an idea that it's, that kind of knowledge, that we're in an illusion, we're a product of this projected reality, so therefore we must be evil that we can see it, or we're going to ruin it for everybody else, maybe. I don't know, that's part of how I take it. I take it in a Buddhist way, that this is an illusion, we're walking through it, where we've made the dream and now we're walking through the dream. And so I find that interesting. When any fourth wall is broken, I always love it.
To me, it's one of the most fascinating examples of a way of attempting to aesthetically or narratively represent these states of consciousness, or as we were calling it, metaconsciousness, which are otherwise very difficult to describe, especially given that this really seems to refer to discussions of mystical awareness.
Yes.
And that is often interacts with magical worldviews in interesting ways, very esoteric ways, but of course is sometimes also conflated with them. And I like these characters because None of the three characters I mention are magicians, although apparently Frank Underwood likes to do little anti-religious rituals that might apparently focus his ambition, but you certainly don't see him making any diabolical pacts in any overt way. And yet, these characters seem to have a meta-conscious awareness, which is shown as distinct from magic. And I think that's really interesting. And
yes, and I think, I guess, at the end of this coming to a close for me, I want to say that I had this feeling of that this idea of magic, and I would call it innovation and creative energy that would be transcendental or meditative or meta-conscious, I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing it so much in creativity in TV shows and movies, because it's a great metaphor for being an artist and being a creative person is to push your boundaries of your belief systems.
Well, I'd love to see a representation of a character who is a magician and has this metaconsciousness.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, if someone listening is a creator of scripts, shows, or films, perhaps I hope someone will be inspired to make such a
character. Did you hear that, independent or Hollywood creative types? Can you do that for us? Eugene?
Hopefully Hollywood will get right on that.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, Eugene?
No, I just would like to say that I really appreciate your giving us a taste of this really broad range of ideas that you're discussing in your panels. I think it's really fascinating and fantastic, and I really appreciate hearing from you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to take these conversations from the medium of the live conference to the medium of the podcast.
Right, that's very exciting.
It adds, it really adds something already to what was already a great conference.
Yes,
and is a great contribution to sharing these ideas and their exploration with a wider audience.
Yes, thank you so much, George. I really appreciate your time and coming out, and Eugene putting up with us, not sounding so great on the recording, perhaps.
It's not too bad, Candy, sound-wise. I think we're going to be fine.
Okay, well, great.
Thank you for a great conversation, Candy and Eugene. I really enjoyed talking to both of you.